When the world speeds up, when the pace of change speeds up, some people embrace it, some people resist it, even if they can't stop it. And boy, are we living at such a time. Even some people who think about the future for a living think this moment stands out.
I've been doing 10-year forecasting for 30-some years now.
This is Bob Johansson. He used to head the Institute for the Future in Palo Alto, California, where I was a fellow last year.
And this is the most frightening 10-year forecast I've ever done. And I've been saying that for the last 5 years. So it's been accelerating in terms of threat.
These 10-year forecasts, which Bob still does with the Institute for the Future, are meant to help people think about trends and about what might be coming and what might already be here that could shape lives going forward. One trend that's been hard to miss is the rise of populist strongman leaders in places like Russia, China, Turkey, the Philippines, and, of course, in the United States.
We will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea.
Donald Trump and all these guys love to sound strong, certain, totally in command. They scoff at norms. They try to discredit checks on their power. They aim to concentrate as much power as possible in their own hands. None of that's great for a democracy. But what if this is also flat out the wrong kind of leadership for the kind of future that may lie ahead? This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. And we've seen plenty of examples over this past year of strongman leaders trying to roll back civil rights, democratic norms, norms of civility, and trust in government, other than trust in the strongman. In each of the countries where this is happening, some people are aghast and others are cheering. It's exactly what they want. Someone who says he can fix the problems of the nation, take down the privileged elite, and give power to the people. Their kind of people.
January 20th, 2017 will be remembered as the day the people became the rulers of this nation again. The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer.
That the guy in the White House is a billionaire supporting tax policies that will make the American working class and much of the middle class worse off doesn't seem to register. Because there's this phenomenon that social scientists study. In times of rapid and disorienting change, people who trust order and authority and distrust outsiders and social change are more likely to turn to someone they think can protect them from that change, maybe even make it go away. But Bob Johansson says many of the challenges out there today aren't something that one leader in one place can control, and they aren't going away.
So I'm particularly concerned about things like global climate disruption, which is unprecedented. I'm particularly concerned about cyber terrorism. The one that I'm increasingly concerned about now is what I'm thinking of as weaponized synthetic biology, the potential for synthetic biological structures to break in to genetic forms or to other kinds of natural state in a way that is weaponized.
And all this is happening in a world the U.S. military, specifically the Army War College, calls VUCA, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. Bob Johansson isn't with the military, but as a futurist, he learns from everybody, and he's visited the War College several times. We sat down in his Silicon Valley home to talk about his new book, The New Leadership Literacies, Thriving in a Future of Extreme Disruption and Distributed Everything. Basically, it's an argument for what makes for effective leadership in a VUCA world. In our conversation, Bob started by flipping the acronym VUCA from describing a certain kind of future to describing the leadership traits needed to thrive in it.
And what I realized was volatility yields to vision. So vision gets rewarded disproportionately in a VUCA world. Uncertainty yields to understanding. So in a VUCA world, you just have to listen more. You have to have extreme situation awareness. Complexity yields to clarity. And this is maybe the most important of the insights that come from VUCA is clarity gets rewarded but certainty gets punished. And finally, ambiguity yields to agility. So you have to be really agile to thrive in this world.
So as you look at the examples of leadership we have around us at the moment, how much do you see examples of people who have the skills that you think are needed in the next 10 years?
We see this wild mix now of leadership and leadership styles, from leaders that are far too certain and not nearly clear enough, to other leaders that are expressing a kind of clarity in ways that become inspiring. And I'm particularly interested in young people here and people who have that ability to be very clear directionally or very flexible about execution. And they typically are in what I call shape-shifting organizations, where hierarchies come and go. There's no center. They grow from the edges where diversity flourishes. And they can't be controlled, but they can be guided. So the military has a language for this. They call it commander's intent, or at a larger scale, mission command, or the latest term is flexive command. So what you want is that clarity of direction, flexibility of execution, but you want constant situation awareness to determine who's in the best position to make which decision at what time.
In the United States in particular, but not only in the United States, there seems to be a fairly large group of people who feel that, you know, sort of certainty and staying the course is a sign of good leadership. You know, we heard that under George W. Bush. We heard criticisms of people who said, well, I supported that until I didn't. And the idea that, you know, new information should be considered and that you should be prepared to change your mind based on the new information almost seems like a character flaw in some circles. So, I mean, how do you get the general population to recognize the importance of agility, that it's not wishy-washy to say, well, yeah, I did think that, but now that I know this other information, now I think something quite different.
So the VUCA world, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, is just too much for a lot of people. And when you can't handle the VUCA world, you're ripe for simplicity. Being simple is good, but being simplistic is dangerous. And in this world, you're open to political forms of extreme simplicity, to religious forms of extreme simplicity. What happens is we all kind of pick a side that makes us more comfortable. We all have these personal neural story nets, that's what the neuroscientists call it, that we're telling ourselves stories all the time. And in a VUCA world, the stories don't work very well. So we have to go back to our old stories. And these simple stories just make us feel more comfortable. But that can get really, really dangerous. So that's why the leaders, the leadership, has to seek out clarity. And clarity of direction is important to stay the course in that sense. But you need to be very flexible about execution.
But it also requires selling it. Because when you're a leader, it's an interaction between you and whoever you're providing leadership to. And if those to whom you're providing leadership think, oh, you're being wishy-washy. Oh, you know, this is different from what you said before. And you've got this chorus of naysayers saying, oh, you see, this is a bad leader. This is a weak leader because you can't count on him or her to be consistent. How do you get past that?
Not easily. Yeah, there's no easy way out of this. It's a VUCA world there too. And the 24-hour news cycle, the breaking event thing that comes on every 15 minutes, there isn't a breaking event every 15 minutes. Really interesting, I think, that our expectations now have been so amped that we need a kind of calming combined with a kind of directional clarity. The military is way ahead of most of business in this. There's a few industries, I think healthcare, particularly emergency rooms and disaster preparedness. If you look at how an emergency room operates, that's shape-shifting. You know, leadership comes and goes, you're kind of reorganizing. If you look at the military, it's the special forces. It's not the conventional part of the military.
And in fact, at one point in your book, you talk about a protocol where the person who's out in the field can say, I'm going to do this unless you tell me otherwise. This is what I'm planning to do. So it gives a lot of leeway to the person who's in the field. They've got information in the field that the person back at headquarters doesn't have.
Yes, interesting. That's a Navy concept called UNIDIR, which basically means unless otherwise directed. So again, it's a form of clarity of direction, flexibility of execution. We all need disciplines like that to thrive in this kind of world, and that's what leadership looks like.
And it also suggests that there's trust in delegating authority.
It assumes trust. You know, the leadership in the future, there's a lot of enduring leadership qualities that don't go away. And certainly trust is one of those. You need trust. What you need in this case, though, is an envelope of trust that allows for lots of flexibility within the envelope. And what my friends in the military tell me, in the Army in particular, where I've worked the most, is their transformation began in the Vietnam War when they realized that these sort of symmetrical warfare methods weren't working anymore because it was more and more asymmetrical warfare and asymmetrical opponents that weren't playing by the rules. So that long transformation has now been played out. And the really frightening thing about it, the criminals are better at this than we are, especially the terrorists. You know, some of the terrorist groups, Al-Qaeda in particular, very good at how they organize these things.
So you mentioned in your book, Daniel Suarez's book, yeah. Demon. So Daniel Suarez is a science fiction writer, yeah. And this book is about this demented genius who dies but has left all kinds of programming in his wake.
Yeah, that's the scariest book I've read.
Me too. I had nightmares after.
Yeah. This word daemonic has always interested me. And I went to divinity school and I still study world religions. And that notion of the daemon, you know, D-A-E-M-O-N, we've simplified it down to demon and said it's only evil. But daemonic is intense energy, which can go either positive or negative. And in the VUCA world, you're dealing with those kind of daemonic forces much more intensely. And you got to be ready for that. So that's the kind of preparation that's needed to engage with this kind of world, because there's clearly demonic forces, but there's also daemonic forces in the positive sense. And we've got to be able to look for both and see both.
So I want to go back to what you said at the very beginning, which was that you find this next decade to be perhaps the most volatile of any that you've looked at, and that in a way it kind of scares you, at least part of the potential for what it might become scares you. You were active as a futurist in the 80s, and at that time, there were some pretty massive changes happening too.
Sure.
Did it feel fundamentally different than what you're feeling now?
Yeah, I think I'm more aware now, possibly. That could be it. When I turned 50, one of my friends said, "You now have license to play the wisdom game." And I think part of the wisdom game is to realize the impact of scale and to realize the impact of global perspective. We have a global perspective now that has never been possible before. And what I realized when I wrote this book is my career arc has roughly followed the arc of the internet, originally the ARPANET. So the ARPANET was introduced in 1968. It was still classified, publicly introduced in 1972, where I did a paper. And it was...
And you annoyed the people at the conference because you were seeing a vision for the ARPANET that they weren't.
Yeah, it was really a strange experience. This is my first professional paper, and I was only there because I misunderstood the title of the conference. It was called the International Conference on Computer Communications, and I assumed that meant people communicating with people through computers. And there was four others on the panel who misunderstood the conference too, and somehow we were accepted. But right when I did my talk, a young, impassioned computer scientist stood up in the back of the room, and he was so angry at us that he just yelled at us and said, "The use of the ARPANET for people communicating with people was a misuse of CPU," and he stormed out of the room. And I was just stunned. But I realized that he was actually right, that the purpose of the ARPANET in those days was data communication among defense contractors. But the underlying message was the core technology developed by Paul Barron and others was packet switching. That created the potential for shape-shifting organizations.
So packet switching, of course, for the few people out there who might use the internet but not know how it works, is?
What it means is when you send a signal like a message, your message gets broken down into packets and it doesn't get reassembled till the other end. So if any portion of the network is taken out for whatever reason, the rest of the network continues. So there's no center, it grows from the edges, it can't be controlled. It was developed at the time of centralized networks in the Cold War. And the risk was if you took down any portion of the network, it took down the whole network.
And it's important to spring off of that too, how you're looking at leadership in the next decade, that in fact, rather than there being a central hub, that leadership you describe in the book should be a bit more like packet switching, or a lot more like packet switching.
I did a book in 1994 with Rob Swigert, the novelist. We first saw these kinds of organizations happening then, but we called them fishnet organizations in those days. You know, we made the classic futurist mistake of overestimating the impact in the short run, but underestimating in the long run. It hasn't happened as quickly as we thought, but now it's ready to scale.
So fishnet organizations, you had an illustration in the book, which was helpful because otherwise I was thinking, what?
So you imagine a fishnet lying on a dock and you pick up a node and a temporary hierarchy forms. You put that down, you pick up another node, a temporary hierarchy forms. And in my talks, I've animated it. So it actually isn't a single organization. It's a landscape of these kind of shape-shifting forms.
So then the elephant in the room is the human ego. You know, you get people who reach for power, who think they should be leaders because they think they're superior. They think they should have the voice that decides which way an organization is going to go, and that if they only have power for some of the time or they only make an intervention once in a while, it's just not the same. How do you move from organizations that have leaders in a central role as a hub to this fishnet kind of leadership?
So leadership doesn't go away. It still works fine in stable, predictable environments where your competitors and your structure is very clear and not very changeable. There just aren't very many cases like that anymore. So we're just going to have to get used to these more shape-shifting forms. The notion of the ego in this case, the ego of the leader, it has to be less of an isolated ego and more of a collective ego. So in other words, you imagine yourself appearing across the shape-shifting organizations. And I just presented the new book to the CEO of a very large organization. And he looked at this animation of the shape-shifting structure of organizations. And he said, "Where do I sit?" So I have sort of taken aback. And then I said, "I'm not sure you sit at all. I think you run and maybe dance. But where you would sit structurally is more at the bottom, not at the top." So the leader is the foundation. And it does link to the notion of servant leadership, which I think is now coming back into style. Servant leadership. So it's leadership from behind. And what I'm arguing, it's leadership from below, where your leadership at the foundation.
So a decade from now, in your vision, it's not that corporations or NGOs or governments won't have specific people who are the leaders. It's just that the way that they lead will be different.
Yes, and I think the designations are likely to be different too. There's going to be more shared leadership, but I still think there will be leaders that are designated, but there'll be a lot of fluidity about who leads at which time. To go back to your question about ego, the isolated ego that's really insecure and looking for self-praise, it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough because you're in a world where leaders' hierarchies come and go, and there still will be the rock star leaders, but they won't last long for the most part. There'll be exceptions, but they won't last long because they'll be so visible that they'll become really big targets. The kind of leadership that'll work best is this combination of strength and humility and very extreme sophistication about choosing which medium is good for what. You know, in person will still be very important. And you know, most of today's leaders are great in person, but they degrade when they're not there physically. And one of the new literacies I talk about is you have to learn how to be better than being there when you're not there physically.
So let's expand on that a little bit. How can you be better than being there?
I grew up thinking about multimedia communication. So my first role as a futurist was I was the social scientist studying a prototype system very much like Facebook in the 70s for scientists communicating with scientists. We didn't call it social media. We had this nerdy name, computer conferencing, we called it. But it's basically the functionality of Facebook. We've really been doing social media since the 70s. You know, we think it's relatively recent, but it's actually, you know, it's taken 30, 50 years to finally become more routine. What's next is you're going to have sensors everywhere. You know, these sensors are, many of them will be connected. Most of them will be very cheap. Some of them will be in our bodies. And will be, the leaders are going to be wearing their computer resources. So face-to-face will still be important, but in the book, I try to break out what are these options from, you know, same time, same places in person to different times, different places, asynchronous, same time, different place, different time. And of course, anytime, any place, you know, the smartphone world. And that's the whole space that we have now combined with sensors. So it means that leaders will be able to sense how people are doing. And they're going to have to figure out how to do that in such a way that they're close to people they're working with without being too close. In the robotics field, this is called the uncanny valley. You want to get as close to being there as you can without being spooky or weird or prying.
I'm going to say, when I read that part of the book, I got kind of creeped out.
Yeah, no, it's very sensitive. And you got to figure out what works in which environment.
In a way, the future vision of people having sensors so their bosses can know how they're feeling, yes, as a substitute for actually checking in with them and seeing how they're feeling feels more disconnected.
It's not as a substitute. If it is a substitute, that won't work. It's more of a mix. So what if you have the ability to crowdsource key variables of commitment, of hope, of anger, and do that in more than these kind of boring corporate surveys, but do it in much more continuous sensors-based approaches. That can work. And again, the military's tried to do this, and in some cases has done this pretty well, where commanders are actually able to get a much better sense of all the players, combining in-person experiences with virtual experiences.
Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate. How do you know if someone has sensors and you're reading the sensors that they're reacting to you or exclusively to you, and it's not an argument they had that morning with their partner or someone who cut them off in traffic, or they just didn't get enough sleep, or there's something else going on?
You don't. I'm not saying this answers everything. I'm just saying it gives you a much different, and I think potentially better and more accurate perspective on the range of things that are going on. It'll still require emotional intelligence. It'll still require big data analytics now to make sense of all that. It's got the potential to link leaders and leadership in a much closer, more accurate way than what we've been able to do in the past.
I will also say with all humility that I am not an early adopter of technology. And as you've said in the book, you know, you've made a number of forecasts over the course of your career and you've usually been right. So while I can't envision this for myself, I'm probably not the person who will be targeted for having sensors embedded in them so that their boss can know how they're doing.
You know, I doubt if I am either. I'm a futurist, but I'm not necessarily an early adopter. And all I'm saying as a forecaster is that we're going to have a much wider array of options, and we're going to have to be much smarter about digital options to make decisions about which media to use for what.
So zooming back out to decisions made on a global scale and leadership that affects what happens on a global scale, there are all these big challenges that we're dealing with now: climate change, terrorism, cyber terrorism. And yet it feels like in the midst of this moment of significant change and significant challenge that a lot of people have as a sort of almost reflexive response to reach for populist leaders, to reach for strong leaders. Donald Trump, Xi Jinping, Vladimir Putin. I mean, the Chinese didn't really get a say in Xi Jinping coming to power, but he's very popular in China. It's also true, it seems to me, that appropriate leadership in the moment really matters, and that if you don't have that in a moment when there's such extraordinary flux, mm-hmm, things could go seriously off the rails.
the way I describe the current mood, and again, I'm a futurist, I'm looking 10 years ahead. The way I describe the current mood is I use the word scramble, that's what we're in. We're in a scramble. A lot of things that have been stuck are going to get unstuck. And many of these current leaders that are more populist in nature are really good at unsticking things. From what I can tell, they're not going to be very good at putting them back together again. So there's going to be an unusually high number of unintended consequences. You know, there's always some, but a lot more over the next decade, which means as a futurist, I say, this is interesting because that makes it a ripe time for innovation. If you're ready to play beyond the polarities of the present. But if you get stuck in or sucked into the polarities of the present, you can get bogged down really quickly in those kind of things. So you need ways of flipping those dilemmas into things that are quite different than what were the case before. So for example, we're not going to be able to rely on central government for global climate disruption policies to the extent that I, as a futurist, wish we could. But we're now at a point where there's really interesting market forces, and you can see them even in strange places, unexpected places like Texas, you know, where wind energy is actually growing, solar energy is actually growing, and in some cases is actually replacing fossil fuel investment. This notion of the scramble is, I think, a very healthy way to look at the next decade. If you assume that, hey, it's a scramble, I'm going to thrive anyway, that's really different than if you assume that things are going to stabilize and, oh, we're going to get through this and then we can go back to the way we were. We're not going to go back to the way we were. And if you, to get back to this notion of the right language to describe it, you can't use problem solver language to talk about the scramble. You have to realize that many of these things are dilemmas. They're not problems that can be solved. They're problems that won't go away, but we have to figure out how to make them better anyway. So if you take another current example or recent past example, when Obamacare was first being pushed through the system, problem solver language is everywhere. It was solving the problem of healthcare. The current administration's falling into the same trap. Healthcare is not a problem that can be solved. It's a dilemma. You can improve it, you can't solve it. So a lot of, I think, the challenge is if you use problem solver language and you don't solve the problem, you're in big trouble. This scramble is going to require just a whole different mentality about what we expect and how we engage.
When was the last time we were in a scramble?
Oh, you know, scrambles happen all the time. I'm talking about a global scramble.
So when's the last time we were in a global scramble?
I don't think we ever were in a global scramble. The scale of this, the global scale and the risks associated with the global scale, that's what's new. It does all go back to connectivity, you know, this radical connectivity now. And that's both the source of the hope that I have, because there's now the possibility of engaging with these things at a global scale. And the fear, because it's possible to amplify that kind of destructiveness in ways we haven't been able to do before.
I also just wanted to ask about one other word you chose, stuck, unstuck, that populist leaders are really good about unsticking things. I think the way that that word is used often, you know, something being stuck feels negative. You want to unstick it. You want things to flow. But is another way of looking at it that things were stable and then are unstable?
Yes. So populist leaders offer the hope of unsticking things that people are frustrated about. And the challenge of that is how to deal with the fact that the unsticking could actually happen. But the real risk here isn't authoritarianism or totalitarianism, particularly in this very distributed world. The real risk is just that you break down the governing structures so much that it's hard to put them back together again.
So it could be broken rather than just unstuck.
Exactly. Yeah, it's one thing to be unstuck. It's another thing to be broken.
Yeah.
Right. How far can you go before you can't put it back together again? Now, the hopeful part of that is there may be new ways of putting things back together again. So it's looking for new models, because if you just end up fighting the latest populist politician, you get stuck in the polarities of the present and you're right back where you started from. Instead of what I like to say, it's too late to catch up, but it's a great time to leapfrog.
So I know your usual time frame is 10 years, but my podcast is called Whose Century Is It?
Yeah.
So if you look forward a lot further, How do you think leadership will continue to evolve?
Yeah. I think what's going to happen if you go further out, how deep in the century do you want me to go?
Go all the way through if you want to.
So that's like 80 years? 80 years, yeah. 80 years from now, we'll sort of look back as silliness about the distinction between being online or offline. The virtual and the physical will be much more highly connected than now. So what it means for leadership is we'll have less need for formal hierarchical structures. I'm really optimistic on that long-term time horizon if we're able to get through the scramble. And the scramble is, it really is a question, how many people just can't deal with the VUCA world? And that's really an important political question right now. And obviously there's a lot that are just saying, I can't deal with this, and are going for what I think are simplistic choices. If we can get through that period, as the technology becomes much more blended and much more graceful and much more integrated, the potential to do really great things becomes very high.
I love the optimistic note. But as you were talking, I was thinking, sometimes things really do fall apart. Sometimes people really can't deal with the way the world is changing and things kind of blow up. And then I was also thinking, the dark ages lasted a really long time. What would a high-tech dark ages look like?
Yeah, get back to Daniel Suarez. Yeah. This is the most frightening 10-year forecast I've ever done and the most optimistic. And I think that's the important thing about this period. The stakes are up in ways they've never been before. So we can't really come back and say, oh, we're just going to focus on our country. It just doesn't work that way, the way the distributed future is playing out. You know, we can pretend that, but we're dealing with a world that's increasingly global, whether we like it or not. And within that world, anything that can be distributed will be distributed. That's just a force of the future now. Anything that can be distributed will be distributed, including leadership.
And that means there won't be a central leader. There won't be a center that dictates this is how things are going to be. Different people will have a voice. Different places will have a voice. It won't necessarily be that policy is made in just Washington that matters, but policy that's made in California matters. Mm-hmm. Policy that's made in San Francisco matters.
There's no center. Essentially, I think we've crossed the complexity threshold where we can't just be led with hierarchical structures anymore. We can't be led with singular leaders anymore. There's going to have to be this more shape-shifting leadership structure to work. That's extremely hopeful, and it's very risky.
Hopeful, because technologies are tools, and if you use them wisely, they could enrich many people's lives. Hopeful, because a more multipolar world with more empowered people on the planet means more ideas and talent being shared, more checks and balances against excesses. The risks are there too, especially, if you ask me, when you're talking about embedding sensors in people so leaders have a better idea how they're thinking and feeling. Leave aside that it's a startling invasion of privacy. I mean, even Winston in George Orwell's 1984 had the refuge of his own thoughts, at least for a while. Think of the ways the capability of constantly monitoring people's thoughts and feelings could be used and abused. Think of what it might do to the human psyche when there's no place to hide, no way to step back, when your right to control who knows what about your innermost thoughts is brushed aside just so a leader can have more efficient command and control. What if Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping or Kim Jong-un or Donald Trump could do that right now? And here's another thought. In the same way that ordinary people who prefer order and authority reach for strongman leaders when they feel threatened, strongman leaders aren't necessarily going to go quietly, even if the future is pulling away from strict hierarchies and towards shared leadership coming from the edges. After all, the habits and fears embedded in human biology over hundreds of thousands of years of evolution don't change as fast as technology. Just look at our simian ancestors to see who shares leadership and who fights for it. Okay, other than the bonobos, who, incidentally, are an endangered species. Still, humans, able to stay agile, to lead with clarity but not certainty, with less ego and more insight, have a far better shot of riding this bumpy wave of change in this century and bringing others along for the ride. Perhaps it will even catch on. Thanks to Bob Johansson for his time and insights. You can read more of his thinking on all of this in his book, The New Leadership Literacies, Thriving in a Future of Extreme Disruption and Distributed Everything. The work of the Institute for the Future is at iftf.org. And if you're interested in hearing a social scientist's research into why people support populist strongmen, take a listen to an earlier episode I did called American Authoritarians for Trump. You can find that at Whose Century Is It, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't subscribed yet, please do. You can also find the print version of that episode at pri.org/century. Just type in American Authoritarians for Trump. It'll come up. The new website for Whose Century Is It is whosecenturyisit.com. And there's also a Facebook page with that same name. And as always, thanks for listening. Back soon with another episode.